This meeting of the Senate Health, Housing, and Family Security Committee will come to order. We have a lot of bills, so I will request authors and witnesses be as brief as they can be. We like information, but we want to keep it as brief as we can be. Senator Saxhog is here, and you have two bills on the agenda. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And start with being brief is music to our ears. Senate File 143 is a bill that will help public nursing home facilities with their reimbursement rates to their PAR accounts. And with me today is Carrie Thurlow to briefly go over the bill and help answer any questions.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Thurlow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Carrie Thurlow. I'm the Vice President of Advocacy for the Minnesota Health and Housing Alliance. I will try to be brief. Senate File 143 establishes a formula to reimburse nursing facilities that participate in the Public Employees Retirement Association for their PARA accounts. The rate in the bill summary provides the formula to reimburse for those rates. But first, just a little bit of history. It might be helpful to know that, generally speaking, many of these facilities participated in what was previously considered Rule 50, which was a pre-1995 payment system that was phased out just last year. They are now all, for all practical terms, paid under the same payment system, which is now called the alternative payment system, which really is an alternative to anything, but just kind of by way of background. Under Rule 50, there was a formula that was put in place for facilities to be reimbursed for PARA obligations. Now under the APS system, because all facilities are, the state gives all facilities equal operating rate increases that are applied to the property rate section, PARA is part of the rate that is never adjusted, and so there is no inflation increase or recalculation of actual costs. The problem is that PARA obligations are set by the state and continue to go up and have no control by the employers in this situation. And so this language comes before you as a result of a rate appeal brought forward by the Little Fork facility. And this was language offered by the department as sort of a fix to the problem brought forward by the Little Fork facility. Without giving too much background, I'll just leave it at that. This would help approximately 30 facilities that have PARA obligations and would just allow for reimbursement of their obligations if this were to become law.
Thank you, Mr. Goh. Is the department, this you said their language came from them? Is a formula this?
Mr. Chair, yes, this language was drafted with the assistance of the department. I'm not aware of any opposition to this language.
Questions from the committee? Is there anybody who wanted to speak with concerns about the bill? Do I have a motion?
I'll move.
Senator Berglund moves that Senate File 143 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. Any discussion on that motion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Saxhog, Senate File 769.
Thank you again, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 769 is a bill that will broaden the criteria for reimbursement for adult foster care services. Currently, a person who satisfies all criteria cannot provide services for a family member who is under the age of 65. This bill will reduce the age to 18. It also deletes the provision that would require demonstration of financial hardship. There are other areas of the healthcare industry that have adopted this practice, so what I am proposing is not unprecedented. With me today, and I might say that, however not unique, This particular situation probably comes up in rural Minnesota more than the urban areas, and particularly areas where there's a sparsity of population. With me today is Roxine Skogstad-Ditch, and she'll give some brief testimony and help answer any questions.
Welcome. Hello, I'm Roxine Skogstad-Ditch, and I am here to ask that parents be allowed to have, if they meet the licensure requirements, to be able to have the license for running a group home, the MRRC license. And the reason I ask for that is that, well, many, many reasons, but I'll try to keep brief. I have a daughter that's 24 years old, and we built a group home for her. And we, my husband and I, both meet the licensure requirements for running the group home. But because we happen to have a daughter who is disabled, and she lives there, we can't have that license. And I see it as no different than, for example, when nurses used to not be able to get reimbursed to care for their spouses who needed nursing care. What happened was nurses would start divorcing their spouses in order to get that reimbursement. And, you know, there's no way to, you don't want to ever, and is there, there is no way to just let go of a child who has disabilities in order to be able to run the group home. I can run a group home for my neighbor, but I can't run my own group home, and that doesn't make any sense. And when I look at other situations that are similar, you look at foster care for children, and if parents have other children in their foster care home as well as their own, there doesn't seem to be a worry about conflict of interest there of them making decisions that favor their own children versus a child in foster care. Yet that's one of the reasons that DHS has said in the past they wanted the language that says if you are a parent of a child with a disability, you cannot hold the licensure. And so anyway, there's a whole lot more that I have here, but I think that I should probably maybe ask if you have questions, and then I could go through the rest of it.
Senator Prittner-Solin.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Ms. Skogstad-Ditch?
Deitch.
Deitch.
Yes.
Would this apply in a situation where the disabled child were the only disabled person in the house, or just in a situation where there was a group home and there were other residents there too?
I'm asking for the licensure for group homes. Most group homes cannot even function financially without 4 to 6 people in a group home. But in our situation, we built a group home and we do a lot of work. And so we have 3 gals in the group home. I'm not asking for any kind of licensure that could be used to take care of children within the person's own home.
Senator Prittner-Solin.
Mr. Chair, but Ms. Skogstad-Ditch, does it actually preclude that if there is only one disabled person in the home, does it have to be in a foster child or adult foster
Mr.
resident,
Chair,
I guess.
Members, would you say that again, please?
I'm trying to see if maybe it's related. If somebody just had a family member, I guess it relates to adult family members, they would be emancipated, I assume, after the age of 18. And I'm wondering if this would apply in a situation where, and I don't want to just say just, but where it was the only resident would be the adult child, or if it requires that it be a larger facility with 4 adult foster children, or not yet, foster members there.
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, I guess I can't answer that. I've not known anyone that would have an MRRC license for one child in a home.
Well, my parents did.
Okay.
Is there somebody from the department here who could speak to this, whether the bill would cover individual cases like that?
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Jerry Kerber. I'm the director of the licensing division at the Department of Human Services. And to the question, Senator Solin, the way the Licensing Act has long read, is that the state will not issue a license to care for an adult relative. There is an exception for children related to emergency relative placements of children, but as it relates to adults, there is not. We are not permitted to issue a license to a relative to care for an adult. So what the bill does, so in the setting you're talking about, if there's an adult foster care setting and the license holder is the parent of one of the adults living in the home, that's not prohibited, nor is licensure of the home prohibited. But from the licensing perspective, the child of the license holder is not receiving a license service. And that becomes more significant because if you're not receiving the license services, you're probably not being given access to the funding that would go with the license service.
Okay.
So I think the way the bill is drafted, it seeks to get at the funding without the license.
So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Kervers, it doesn't prohibit the party then from having adult foster care in their home if they have an adult child who is disabled, but it prohibits them from getting funding for that adult child.
Mr. Chair, Senator, any of us could have a license to provide adult foster care services in our home, provided we meet the requirements. The consumers of the adult foster care service then would be someone other than our own children. Or child. Our child could be living in the home and receiving all the exact same services as everybody else, but technically it wouldn't be the licensed service.
Okay.
Senator Worgen?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure how to ask my question because I'm so unclear with the whole thing. So what this does then, if Ms. Skogstad-Deitch were to have a licensed group home, then her child would be treated as a foster child in the facility for reimbursement purposes and treatment and everything. So is that what it does?
Mr. Chair, Senator Worgen, that's what it's seeking to do. I think as I understand, the reference to the particular funding may need some adjustment to address this particular situation, but the intent is that in a licensed setting where all of the other consumers, all the other residents are receiving the funding that goes with the license, this arrangement would allow the funding to flow even if the individual is not technically receiving a licensed service. And that method, that approach then does not require the modification of who can be licensed. It doesn't open it up to the state licensing anybody to care for their adult children.
Mr. Chair, so then in fact, the license holder, if they have a developmentally delayed adult child, would be reimbursed just as though that were a foster child in their licensed facility.
Mr. Chair, Senator Worgen, I think the biological child who happens to be an adult, just one clarification. So, but yes, I think that's the intent.
And then, Mr. Chair, the second piece of the bill says removes the financial hardship. So that would mean regardless of how much money or assets you have, you'd be paid to take care of your own child if you were a licensed home, your own young adult, whatever.
Yes, Madam, Mr. Chair, and members, unless Jerry, you wanted to say, did you want to say something?
Go ahead.
Okay, you know, I guess what I'm finding here is that we're talking on two levels here. For me, there's the concept of being able to run the group home, and have the license for it. And when we start talking about the financial piece of it from DHS, then I think I see a question on your face, Senator Wergen, and I have the same question because I don't have the background in that, in the funding piece for the, I mean, I don't understand all the terminology for the license, the financial part, but what I'm trying to say is that if anyone else can get that licensure, if they meet all of the requirements, and the requirements include things like education in disabilities, having a business plan, having the plan for the workers, the workman's comp, et cetera. And if you have all, if you meet all of those requirements, right now you can't get the license to oversee the running of that group home because you have a relative in the group home. But my point is, I had all the licenses to be my daughter's special education teacher in International Falls, and I was her, she was in my class because I was the one that had the licensure. And so I don't see the difference. Catherine Finlayson from Department of Human Services told me there were two reasons that this had, that it, this statement had in it, that it said relatives cannot hold the license. The one reason was that it said parents should never, their concept was at DHS, parents should never be paid to provide services that are considered normal and reasonable in taking care of a child. However, my argument to that point is that this is not normal and reasonable that we meet all the group home requirements to oversee continuity of care for a child who is disabled and an adult. Also, this no longer applies because under community directed CDCS, the parents are paid to take care of their children who have disabilities. The other concern was the conflict of interest. The conflict of interest, if you follow that line of reasoning, then would be the same types of conflict of interest that a foster care parent would have with children in their home. It would be possibly the same type of conflict of interest that superintendents and principals have when they have their own children in their school districts. I see no difference. And I could have run that group home before I had my daughter, but because my daughter was born and she became disabled, then I can't run the group home.
Sir Wergen.
Well, Mr. Chair, there are a couple differences. My husband and I did foster care for 17 years for teenage girls. And yes, our own children were in the home, but there was no reimbursement for our own children. We were reimbursed for the care of the foster children, not our own children. And the second piece is a question then. If I have a 20-year-old adult child with disabilities, the way this is being changed, I could become, you know, meet the requirements and become licensed as an adult foster care facility and be fully rate reimbursed for my own adult child.
Mr. Chair and members, the difference is once a child becomes an adult, no parent is financially required to support that person. So, of course, there'd have to be financial reimbursement for an adult who has a disability because they oftentimes don't have enough income to live on their own. Does that answer it?
Senator Berglund and Senator Brittner, so.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Saxhock, I think the problem is that we have a lot of people who take care of their adult disabled children at home and do not get reimbursement for it. In fact, you know, one of the issues we struggle with is having enough funding so that those adult children can be placed in a waiver slot before their parents get too old to take care of them. And if we were going to create a mechanism to pay every parent who's taking care of an adult disabled child, we would need a pretty big tax increase to do it because we're struggling just to try and get the ones out of the family home where the parents are becoming aged.
Mr. Chair and members, I think there's a difference here, because when you are the licensed provider, we're looking at the funding that goes towards these adult people with disabilities is the money that would go for the people who work in the home, not the licensed provider, but the shift workers, the day-to-day workers. You have to have a way to have money to pay those workers. You also are not, I'm not looking at in-home, I'm looking at group home. We have already built a group home for our daughter, and we already have a licensed provider overseeing it. We already have our shift workers there. However, we want to be able to take the funding that is going to the licensed provider and use it for things like that we deem more appropriate, instead of another level of bureaucracy, such as getting better wages for our workers so we can keep our workers in the home, and things that are necessary for the home, such as a vehicle. None of those disabled people usually have their own car, and you have to have a vehicle to transport those people around. All of those kind of expenses are what the money would go for. You could use all the money, instead of giving one more licensed person a pot of money that he's negotiating with to make a profit to send to his corporation or his business, could be used to improve the standard of living in the group home.
Senator Prittner-Solon.
Mr. Chair, it seems, according to the description of the bill, that those 18 and under and those 65 and older are already allowed to be in family-owned adult or foster care businesses. So it's only this category from 18 to 65 that is eliminated, and that seems like a discrimination to me also.
Senator Torres-Ray.
Mr. Chairman, I think that the provision for 18 and under and 65 and over has to do with vulnerability. And I think that's the provision for placement generally for foster care. So I think that's where I have some questions related to, is this supposed to be just for persons with disabilities? I just don't see the language here. But it goes back to the comment that Senator Berglund made with respect to the implications for this, because when you remove the 65, that basically means absolutely everyone. And it's really significant. And so in terms of looking at how we really certify homes and how we deal with that, I would like to hear from DHS about this is very significant. It really changes everything, because you are not looking at placement of children and you are not looking at placement of vulnerable adults. You're looking at placement of everyone. And I think this is quite significant.
Senator Saxon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Torres-Ray, as I said at the very beginning, prefacing our remarks here, this is somewhat of a rural problem that we have here. It isn't, as I've always said, like the 11-county metro area, where if you need a group home, there's probably one within short driving distance. In rural Minnesota, particularly if you're in International Falls, you may be as far as 90 miles away from your closest potential group home. And so if part of the solution here is allowing some parents to put together a group home and in fact maybe being compensated for having their adult child in there, I think that's a small price to pay for taking care of what can be a tough situation.
Senator Prittner-Solon.
Mr. Chair, but like Senator Torres-Ray, I'd like to hear from Mr. Curvers, because I think that anybody who would qualify would have to be a vulnerable adult anyways.
excuse me, Mr. Chair and members. I want to make one thing clear here. This doesn't open up any additional providers for licensure. It's a mechanism called certification by a county. And so the certification by the county under this proposal would become available. It's a certification for access to funding, would become available to people who cannot be licensed, this subset of people who are not eligible to be licensed. So the bill doesn't seek to change who can and who cannot be licensed. But it does certainly seek access based on a county certification to the funding sources that would, I'm not familiar with these funding sources, and as I mentioned before, my understanding is that there would probably need to be an adjustment to the funding source that's referenced here to address this particular situation even. But the funding has certain qualifications too about who is eligible for that funding. What are the disabilities of the individual involved?
So, Mr. Chair, what you're saying is that these individuals are already eligible, and if they don't go to their home, they go to some other group home.
Mr. Chair, and
if it's available,
Solon, I think that's exactly the case. And the argument that we hear often is that how does it make sense? This is the argument we hear. How does it make sense that the state will pay the person across the street to care for my child and not pay me, and certainly I could provide the loving care that is more appropriate and more efficient and effective.
I just have a follow-up.
Senator Torres,
so does this language take care of, because that makes total sense to me. It's just that I am not reading it here, and that's just my confusion, because I think I'm in full support of that. So your daughter will receive, she will receive payment. You will be able to have reimbursement for the placement in another home, but not in your house, in this case, like you presented. And that makes no sense to me whatsoever. But does this language that you have here takes care of that? I think that's what is confusing to me.
Mr. Chair and members, again, yes, the short answer to your question, Senator Torres Reyes, is yes, I believe so. And the vulnerable adult thing, yes, any time that you have a person with disabilities, doesn't matter what age they are, they have the vulnerability. And there are, I came up with a list of 20 checks and balances that are used in our, because my daughter already gets her MRRC waiver dollars. It's going to another licensor, and she's in her home already. So the dollars are already there. There's no additional dollars that would be done. It's just that the money would be transferred from the licensed person now to hopefully me, who would take over the license instead, so that we could use the money in what we deemed an appropriate manner for the home. In terms of vulnerability, the shift workers that are there as part of the requirements under the consolidated rule, which is a manual this thick, talks about the training that's required for all shift workers in group homes regarding vulnerability adult or vulnerability rules and the reporting of those of any incidences. You have to report to the ombudsman, you have to report to the social worker, you have case managers that you have to report to, you have to keep records of any kind of incidences that happen, you have risk management plans, individual service plans, annual meetings, you have constant checks and balances in the system. I've seen it work for 3 years in my daughter's group home.
Senator Brittany Solar.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I would recommend that Senate File 769 be recommended to pass. And if it has no financial implications, does it have to be re-referred to finance?
It's huge financial
implications. Does.
They are saying it has financial implications.
Mr. Chair, maybe we need to hear what those financial implications are.
This is the department.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dan McCarthy, and I work with the department. think it would be helpful for this bill to be referred to the Finance Division, first of all, because in talking with Senator Sachs-Hogg and Roxanne, there are some intent that the language actually should be modified, that we need to spend a little time on to address all the components. In terms of the fiscal effect of this change, I think what is important for the members to understand is what's being sought is that in those situations when a family member, a parent, is seeking to be treated like any other vendor, she's willing to meet all the licensure requirements. She is hoping that she can use that resource to assure that there's appropriate care for her son or daughter, not in her home. This isn't about her home. This is actually about in a different setting, that she has some role in managing the organization that makes sure the care is in place. But we do need to have the language, I think, shaped a little differently in order to assure that the necessary checks and balances are in place.
So, Mr. Chair, are you saying then that if the language were reshaped, there would not be financial implications?
Well, I think, Mr. Chair and Senator Bretner-Solin, the MRRC waiver is actually managed in the aggregate at the local level. I'm pretty sure you're aware of that, given a couple other bills that are up this session. And so it is a allocation that has a limit. So on some level, we do have individuals who, more individuals who are seeking access to that funding stream than there are resources available. But the county needs to manage all those demands within the allocation that they receive. This would not in any way change the fact that the county has to manage within the allowable average the resources that have been allocated to them.
Okay, so, Mr. Chair, I renew my motion then.
Senator Bretner-Solin moves that Senate File 769 be recommended to pass and referred
finance
to the Committee on Finance. There is discussion on that. Is there anybody else you needed to speak to the bill? Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, just not for you today, Senator Sachs-Hogg, because I realize, but if people do have bills like this, it really is better if you have your bill in shape when you get it to the policy committee, because when you go to my division, then you get your bill fixed and doesn't have a fiscal impact, then it has to be in a queue to get out of finance. And as time goes on, you'll find out that it's not, I mean, you'd rather have your bill on the floor. So if people can get their bills worked out with, so they don't have a financial impact at this stop, it will save you some time and energy.
So,
Senator Bretner-Solin.
Mr. Chair, I'm wondering if Senator Sachs-Hogg would prefer that we lay the bill over while you work on it.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bretner-Solin, I probably just soon have it moved on. I will say that I will take Senator Berglund's words to heart, and Senator Berglund also understands that sometimes you need to get a bill going before you get the attention of people who are able to put it in.
Yes, I do understand, yeah, okay. Mr. Chairman and Senator.
Thank you.
So I guess I renew my motion.
Bretner-Solin renews her motion. Further discussion on that motion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? No. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you. Next, I see we have Senator Olson's in the room.
I guess so.
If you're ready to go ahead with Senate File 1172.
John. Anna's here.
Senator Bonoff.
Sorry, I didn't see. We'll take Senator Bonoff's bill next.
You're going to take them out of order?
We have. Senator Olson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm very happy to be here today presenting Senate File 434. 1172. This is the bill for increased funding for the Block Nurse Program, which is a wonderful program that helps senior elder members of our community stay at home. It basically coordinates services so that working together, whatever government services as well as private sector services are available in a given community, this program helps to put those services together in order to enable people to stay in their homes and avoid nursing home care as long as possible. With me today to present information about this bill are Lee Greenfield, Chair of Elderberry Institute, and Connie Fagg, Program Director for Atwater Living at Home, Block Nurse Program in Atwater, Minnesota. And I also have to testify briefly Art Orozco, who's with Angels Living at Home, Block Nurse Program in McGregor, Minnesota, and Margaret Magnuson. She's from Battle Creek with the Battle Creek Living at Home program in St. Paul.
Thank you, and I will stress to the witnesses to please be brief because we have a lot of bills on the agenda.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Lee Greenfield, chair of the board of the Elderberry Institute. The Elderberry Institute, which is a resource center for the Living at Home Block Nurse programs, and the 40 programs that exist in the state make up the Living at Home Block Nurse program in the state of Minnesota. The Elderberry Institute serves, as I said, as a resource center. It is legislatively required to provide data analysis from the programs and reporting for the local programs to the Department of Human Services. Its role is also to strengthen the local programs and to ensure continued growth in the model of the Living at Home Block Nurse program that has helped organize new Living at Home Block Nurse programs in additional communities. There are 40 nonprofit community-owned Living at Home Block Nurse programs. Each is an independent 501c3 organization organized in its community and run by a board in its community. They provide services to elders to keep them healthy, independent, and at home. They organize nursing home care and voluntary services. In the years 2005 and 2006, they served almost 13,000 Minnesota elders in their homes, and they provided 118,600 hours of volunteer services to those people. The services include homemaker services, advocacy, transportation, friendly visits, health education, health promotion, chores, caregiver support, meals, nursing, and case management, among other things. As our elder population grows, this program becomes a very cost-effective way to help keep elders at home in their communities, avoiding institutional care as long as possible. Local governance and community control assures responsiveness to community's unique needs in maintaining these programs around the state. But give the over to Connie. Connie Feig.
Thank you. I'm Connie Feig, and I'm the program director at Atwater, Minnesota. That's a town of 1,050, about 85 miles straight west of here on Highway 12. We were established in 1988, so we're in existence 19 years now. This truly is a belief by the community that elders need community support, and so they created this program. They believe that keeping elders in their own homes in the community supports the infrastructure of the community also. They saw the model from St. Anthony Park, and we were the first rural site in this program. The board is made up of community members, primarily elder community members. We have a full-time program director, and I have a part-time volunteer coordinator. We're the staff. This is it. Consequently, as program director, I'm out in the field working with elders on a daily basis. We have approximately 45 to 50 volunteers at any one given time, plus some young people in the community raking lawns and helping in the spring and things. We had last year a total of 4,087 volunteer hours, and we had 147 people that we helped, with a little bit of help or with a whole lot of help, depending on the needs of the people. This has made Atwater truly an elder-friendly community. They're very concerned on a daily basis about helping each other out, neighbor helping neighbor. In fact, people do call my office and say, I have a few hours this month to help you, need a volunteer. This is actually happening because of the community creating this program and willing to sustain it. I also function in the role as a coach for Elderberry Institute. I have helped Granite Falls and Grove City and Painesville get their programs up and running. And at present, there is a fellow in Wilmer, which is 15 miles to the west, that is gathering a steering committee to explore creating a Living at Home Black Nurse program.
Good afternoon. My name is Arda Roscoe. I'm retired Air Force, 20 years. We moved from California here to this beautiful state. We fell in love with the McGregor area. We were going to be snowbirds. However, my condition didn't help me out. So I had a triple bypass. I had to stay in the area. I called a friend of mine. They got a hold of Angels, and they sent a person out there to winterize my mobile home. Without their help, a city boy like me, I don't know what I would have done. They did a great job, and they continue to do a great job with me. I have gone through eye surgery, and they've been there to take me places where I have to go, where I can't drive. And I'm sure that they're going to be there when I call them again, when they perform surgery again on my left eye, which is my other eye.
Thank you, Mr. Orozco. Ms. Magnuson.
Thank you. I'm Margaret Magnuson. I live on the east side. I'm in the Conway Battle Creek area. And I have had more help for years now, and I'm able to stay in my home. My husband died 3 years ago, and I still would like to stay there as long as I can. And through the help of the Black Nurse Program, I'm just thrilled to think I can stay there and have the associations I have with them. I've met many fine people that are volunteers, and I have met people that I could help in return. And that makes a lot of difference to me. It makes my life worth the living. And I'm 85 years old this coming June, so I think I've had quite a bit of time to decide what's really great in this world, and this is. And I thank all of you for listening to me.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
Mr. Chair, I think the testimony has really demonstrated that this is, for a relatively very low cost, a very effective program. One of the reasons I was very happy to sponsor this bill is because we don't have a Black Nurse program in my district. I would love to see this program expanded there. I know that not only could we use this program just in terms of meeting people's needs, but I believe it would be a big cost savings if it can be helpful in keeping people out of the need for nursing home care.
Senator Wergen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for coming. Senator Olson, the Black Nurse program is alive and well in my district, and it is a very good program. In some of the rural areas, it has provided the means for some senior citizens to stay in their homes and done very well. That being said, to go from 33 to 51, I'm glad Senator Berglund has to figure out what gets funded and what doesn't. Because I think it's going to be hard to do that. But the one piece of the bill that I don't like, frankly, is line 2.21 through 2.23, where it puts an increase tied to the CPI. I'm not one that likes to see any government spending on automatic pilot. One of the reasons being that not everything has to grow with the CPI. CPI takes a lot of things into consideration. For instance, it takes the cost of housing into consideration. And these block grants don't cover the cost of housing for someone. They cover the cost of some services. So it's not always logical to tie CPI and have funding increases based on that. And so, Mr. Chair, I'd like to support the bill, but I'd like to offer an oral amendment if I could. I'd like to offer that we remove the new language, the underlined language on 2.21 through 2.23, which is simply an automatic inflation clause in the bill.
Senator Wergen moves to delete the new language on lines 2.21 to 2.23. Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Wergen, while I appreciate your comments, I guess I would just ask the members to support the language as it stands. One of the important aspects of this program is the ability to transport people to medical appointments and those types of things. The other thing is that I think we've all heard how demographically we are going to have a large increase of seniors in our population, and I don't think that there's anything that's not predictable about that increase. So the need for these kinds of services is probably going to increase at a much greater pace than the very modest increase that has been tied to this in this bill. Without something like this, we're going to have to be back here more often asking for the money that will really be necessary to meet the need.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Wergen.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, I get that, but there still are things in the CPI that don't apply to this program, and if we add CPI to everything throughout the budget, where do we find the funding for education?
Further discussion on the Wergen motion? Not all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. On the rest of the bill.
Mr. Chairman, I'll move the bill for Senator Olson. Goes to the Finance Committee.
Senator Berglund moves that Senate File 1172, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. Is there any discussion of that? Anybody in the audience wish to speak with concerns about it? I think the people from St. Anthony Park who started this thing are glad to see it growing. And I think it's a great thing. Anyway, further discussion on the Berglund motion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you. Senator Bonhoff, I'm sorry I did not see you in the back corner there. You're welcome to the committee.
Hello, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Welcome.
Before I do anything, I'd like to offer a delete all amendment. You should have the A1 amendment.
Senator Lori will move the A1 amendment for you. Is there author's amendment? Is there any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you. What you have before you today is a bill with regard to family home visiting. And before I talk about the bill, let me just say that I've been very involved in the early childhood education area. And one of the things that has been a problem as we have looked at reaching our children who are most at risk is that, in fact, we're not reaching all those children, that we're not able to make sure that they're coming into the programs that we offer. And so the more questions I asked, the more I was led to the direction of how important home visiting is, because home visiting allows us to have our arms deep into the communities and reach the people who need it very most. Family home visiting is a way of assuring appropriate health and development for young children. So with this bill, we're amending the current statute to really reflect what with current practice and then appropriating additional funding. It's a targeted program. This bill is targeting 200% of poverty and below, and those families with risk factors as determined by the commissioner. Before I turn it over to have my witnesses speak about this bill, I would also just like to say that With this bill, we're offering a comprehensive approach so that we're working with the public health nurses, but we're also working with existing programs out there, like the home visiting that's done with the ECFE programs. So this bill is before you today and is a component of things we're doing in early childhood, but we are bringing it before you and then assuming that Senator Berkland will be hearing it. So today I have Dr. Terry Rose with us, who is the president and founder of Baby Space, and Rob Fulton, who is the director of St. Paul Ramsey County Public Health. So, Dr. Rose.
Great. Hi, I'm Terry Rose. I'm glad to be here with you today. In addition to being the founder and president of Baby Space, I also provide consultation and training across the state to mental health providers, educators, and public health nurses in the area of early childhood mental health. And so I've been in many of the counties that are serving these high-risk families. And I, as I see my job here today, it's to bring you the most latest research and really combine that with what we're seeing through the state of Minnesota. And if we look at brain research, which is really what's helping us and is informing us about the importance of the early years, we see that prenatally, brain development's really genetically driven. And then once the child's born, it's really experience that informs the brain and the child and the things they'll need to do, whether they are growing up in Japan and will be a Japanese speaker or need to learn the nuances of being within the Hmong culture. So the early experience is really what drives that. And we see that typical everyday experiences that children receive with a sensitive caregiver is really what children need to develop the proper foundation in terms of brain development. Unfortunately, not all children begin with that same kind of experience. And our best research right now is coming out of a Romanian study done by Dr. Charles Nelson and Charlie Zina, who went to Romania, and they actually did neuroimaging of the children growing up in the orphanages, the infants and toddlers. And what they found by doing the neuroimaging is that even though these children received nutritionally what they needed, their social environment, that is, as a toddler, you're lined up on a potty chair, tray of food is put before you, and you sit there for an hour until your business is done. Under those conditions, the brain's actually under power. That is, the synapses just don't connect. And why is that? Well, it makes sense. If your conditions are really that bad and that there's no information coming to inform you about how your brain should go together, we're seeing the neurobiological evidence that the brain's just shutting down. Now, those kind of conditions don't exist here. But we do have children that are living in northern Minnesota where she spends 10 hours of her day in a saucer because her mother is so severely depressed that she's laying on the couch. And because she's a single parent, there's no one else in this child's environment. Or a mom who props the bottle for her hearing and sight-impaired baby because as a teen mom, she says, "What does it matter? She can't hear or see me anyway." It's those kind of experiences that are happening for families that home visiting allows us to reach out to the parents who are struggling in the greatest sense that interferes with their ability to be sensitive responders and give those everyday moments that babies need. We know what those are. We know it's chemical use. We know that it's mental illness. We know that it is the complication of living in poverty, the stress that's associated, that makes it a parent less available for those everyday moments that guides brain development. Home visitors provide the information, the knowledge, and the relationship that then we hope the parent is able to use to really provide that nurturing context and environment for their child and relationship that sets them off to a future of being able to learn to have relationships and to engage their own emotions in ways that make them productive members of our schools and our community.
Thank you. Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And before Mr. Fulton goes, I would like to remind all the witnesses, this is not criticism of Ms. Rose, but just to remind all the witnesses, please be as concise as you can because we have a lot of bills and a lot of witnesses on all of them. So, that was not meant to Dr. Rose's comments. Thank you.
Mr. Fulton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Rob Fulton. I'm director of the St. Paul Ramsey County Department of Public Health. We're a large, full-service public health department run by Ramsey County. Our department is a member of the Local Public Health Association. Our county is a member of the Association of Minnesota Counties. And both of these state organizations, as well as my department, support this bill. The Ramsey County Board has set as the highest priority for our department that we must assure that every child 0 to 6 is safe and nurtured. And to that end, the largest section of our 10 public health sections is a section called Healthy Families. It has a staff of over 70, a budget of $5.6 million a year. And of that amount, the county provides $1.9 million of levy. Now, at this point, I'm supposed to turn and introduce Judy, who is a client. Not to offend you, she elected to stay at school and take a test today rather than come and speak. But she did give me permission to share some words that she shared at the House committee 10 days ago. I would never have read to my baby or thought of getting books, and my public health nurse brought books to me and taught me what things I could do with my children to make me better, meet their needs, and be a good mother. My nurse helped me learn many things my mother was not able to teach me, such as caring for children, being a good mother, and realizing that I really could graduate from high school and do some positive things that no one else in my family had done. My five-year-old is really smart and helps the preschool teachers at his childcare translate what the other children are saying. He's already enrolled in St. Paul Magnet School. Judy is a mother. She was pregnant at 12. She had her first child at 13. And this is what's happening to her after being in our public health program for a number of years. I will graduate this spring at the age of 18 from Arlington High School. In January, I was student of the month at Arlington. I think that I am the first teen mother to be homecoming queen at Arlington High School. This summer, I was worker of the month at a summer job. I now live in stable housing with responsible adults other than my mother, and I've been accepted into the Promise of You program with St. Paul College and hope to become a nurse. Let me add a few points about our program of voluntary family home visiting. It's been in existence since the mid-1980s, and each year it has grown. Right today, we have 900 families open for service in our program. We also have evaluation data that I want to share with you about our adolescent pregnancy program. At the time of completing our services, 96% of the children were up to date on their well-child exams and immunizations. 95% of the families show positive parenting child attachment. 100% of the children had health insurance, and only 3% of the mothers enrolled in our program had had a subsequent birth as an adolescent. And 60% of our adolescent mothers completed high school. Our family home visiting services are based on a well-researched best practice model developed and researched by David Olds. His longitudinal research has followed families who have received public health nurse services for over 15 years. His research shows that 48% less incidence of child abuse, and mothers show an 83% increase in workforce participation. I just downloaded a Brookings Institution report dated January 07. This is a series they're doing called Budgeting for National Priorities, where they're looking at benefit cost evidence. And the cost-effective investments they cite for children are a nurse home visiting program to promote sound prenatal care and healthy development, high-quality early childhood education programs for 3- and 4-year-olds, school reform with an emphasis on programs in high-poverty elementary schools, and programs that reduce the incidence of teen pregnancy. I'll be glad to answer any questions that you might have at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Fulton. Any questions for Dr. Rose or Mr. Fulton?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Fischbach.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Fulton, you said voluntary. What's the sign up like? How does someone get involved?
In this case with Judy, we were referred from the St. Paul Public Schools Enrollment Placement Center, where she first enrolled in school. We contacted her. We would contact them first by phone and ask if we could meet with them. We meet with them. We explain the program to them, and then they can decide whether they want to participate or not.
Okay, so if in that initial, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Mr. Fulton, in that initial phone call, if they say they're not interested.
That's it.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bonner.
Senator Fischbach, that is very important to me as well, the voluntary component, and as I understand it, even if somebody first, you know, comes to their, no matter what, the people can say they're not interested in the services, and then there's nothing more is done.
And Mr. Chair, and maybe to both of you, I guess,
Are we trying to, where are we going with the program in general? I guess as I was looking at the legislation, number 11 says other risk factors as determined by the commissioner. And there's already a list of quite a few. I guess I'm wondering what are some of those other risk factors, because you guys cover quite a few in the legislation already that are existing and then additional.
I don't know if someone from the department is here. Maybe they could answer that.
Is someone?
Okay.
I don't believe anyone is here.
Is there somebody from the department who wanted to comment on other risk factors?
Is Ms. Ring, is that something Ms. Ring would like to comment on? No.
or if
you know, I know, for example, with the early childhood family education, and we are looking at a collaborative approach, one of the risk factors is free and reduced lunch. So it was my understanding that that would be an additional risk factor if we know the family is that may not be listed there. I think what you're seeing is a pretty comprehensive program.
Well, Mr. Chair, and whoever would like to, you already cover the poverty guidelines, the 200 at or below 200% of poverty guidelines, and then if you're, you know, you use the example of the free and reduced lunch, I would think that would already be covered. I guess in what
Mr. Chair and Senator Fischbach, in many cases we may not have data on some of those families until maybe a family member shows up in our public schools, and so by capturing them in many different ways, I think we have our best shot of reaching those who need it most.
May I, Mr. Chair?
Dr.
Terry Rose. From my experience across the state, there are counties that have specific needs that may not be captured here. For example, if we're in the middle part of the state near St. Cloud, we have a number of parents that are incarcerated in that area. So having home services for incarcerated parents. Another example would be families that are in the military, for example. If we have a high concentration, that's an extremely stressful time, and there might be opportunities where we want to offer home visiting for the spouse that is remaining home while the other spouse is deployed. So I could see those, just from my experience across the state, being the kind of nuances that someone, a commissioner, may want to make.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think we're really opening it up. I mean, that's very broad because it talks about other families determined to be at risk. You know, you have the 200 up on, and I realize that's existing, but, you know, in lines 114 and 115, you know, including but not limited to, and then you add number 11 down on line 130, and it's really opened it up. And I mean, and reason I ask about the voluntary is because when my son was born, Lord knows, a long time ago now, 17 years ago, I was contacted numerous times and had to continue to refuse, and I didn't show any of the risk factors. And, I mean, I had to refuse repeatedly phone calls on saying, no, thank you, no, thank you. Yeah, and that's why I'm concerned that that people are, you know, contacted even though, first of all, they don't show any risk factors, and number two, that it's repeatedly.
Mr. Chair and Senator Fischbach, from my understanding, that there's more need out in our community than we're able to give, and that we know with our kids who are coming to school not ready to learn, one of the most important things we can do is reach them as early as possible, and this bill is designed for that. And I think if we got feedback that we were being overly intrusive as a state, which I can't imagine given the amount of need there is in our communities, I think we would take steps, and perhaps we should have a feedback back to the committee on a regular basis for a way to communicate concerns or complaints. But I don't share that concern with what I've been hearing, but I appreciate where you're going with it.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just think that, you know, I realize that you're backed off of the universal family home visits, but I still think that there are some issues with opening this up. You know, the other risk factors determined by the commissioner, I think, just makes it so broad that you could do anything.
Very good. Thank you.
We do have several witnesses who wish to speak in opposition to the bill. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Dr. Karen Ephraim, Twyla Braze, and Tom Pritchard, if you want to come up. Be great. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Dr. Karen Ephraim. I'm a pediatrician, a mother of three, and a policy analyst here on behalf of both EdWatch and the National Physician Center to raise concerns about this bill. The home visiting bills have been an issue for a good long while, and this is not the first move into that area. I have for the committee testimony that I wrote for Congress, who is considering a national $400 million home visiting bill that raises the same concerns that I'm about to bring up. First of all is efficacy. A 1999 national review of six Healthy Families America, which used to be called Prevent Child Abuse America, home visiting programs revealed, quote, no well-constructed control group study of an HFA program has shown clear success in reducing child abuse rates or measures of child abuse potential in a given target population, end quote. That study also found that comprehensive services could cost as much as $47,000 per family in 1999 dollars and still show no improvement in the cognitive development of the child. In addition, proponents of home visiting programs admitted during that hearing of the testimony that I wrote that national studies performed in 2004 and 2005 were also not effective in decreasing child abuse rates. There are several parental rights concerns, some of which have been mentioned by Senator Fischbach. There's the medical and other record review without consent. Consent may not be voluntary for participation. They found in the 1999 study that women were asked about this during labor. And then there are the people that are on government programs that either openly or subtly were coerced with the thought about receiving benefits for participating. Visitors may have a very little bit of training. The information may be presented may be unscientific or biased, and it is the role of the federal or the state government not to promote information that goes with one particular philosophy, especially if there's no scientific basis behind it. There's data collection issues, which I'll let others speak about, and the families may be unknowingly giving up their Fourth Amendment rights because we have the dual role of the home visitor being both a help and an advocate, but also a mandated child abuse reporter. Finally, more recent studies of the Nurse Family Partnership Program, the old studies that were mentioned by the previous testifier, they did find in that study some significant improvements in maternal behavior, but no effect on any of the following, including child's behavior problems or emotional regulation, mother-child interaction, child's mental development, the mother's educational achievement or employment, and those are all direct quotes from the studies, which you have the references in my handout. The delete all amendment is somewhat a step improved that it is not an overt universal program. However, it is expanding the program to prenatal. It is by the factors that Senator Fischbach mentioned, expanding the people that are involved. And there's also other data collection issues with the Minnesota Automated Recording Student System, which is putting the children into yet another educational database. And the bill allows sharing between a full roster of government agencies of medical, mental health, home environment, and family interaction data. So all of those things should be considered. There are other ways to help families, including promotion of marriage and stable two-parent families, which is the best prevention of child abuse and the best way to educate a child, making child safety a top priority by dealing with family preservation efforts and limiting time in foster care, and prevention efforts such as voluntary family education and support classes and community-based respite care centers as opposed to the more invasive and less effective home visiting programs. I'll just conclude by mentioning not all of them, but there are four Supreme Court cases that clearly delineate that it is the parent, not the government, that is in charge of raising children. And my favorite one is Pierce versus Society of Sisters, which says that the child is not the mere creature of the state. Those who nurture him and direct his destiny have the right, coupled with a high duty, to recognize and prepare him for additional obligations. So I would just ask you to keep that in mind as you consider this bill.
Thank you, Dr. Ephraim. Ms. Brace.
Mr. Chair.
Senator.
I just want to draw members at your attention to subdivision 3E on line 3.24 to 3.31, making sure the members do understand that nobody can share data on any child without the express written permission of the parent, who is, of course, fully responsible and the primary caregiver in every way of our children.
Go ahead. Ms. Brace.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Twyla Brace. I'm president of Citizens Council on Healthcare. And because Senator Bonhoff has brought up that section first, I will address that first, which is outside of my comments, to have you note that on line 3.25, that it says that the data must not be disclosed by providers of home visiting services. However, that's really not delineated who that is, and in fact, the information is disclosed by those who come into the home and sent to the Department of Health, and a lot of the parents probably are not aware that that information is being sent directly to the state government. And then if you go to line 3.29, you'll see that the home visiting service have to provide them with information on disclosures, but it's only a general purpose of the disclosure. And so we have no idea really what's being disclosed at all to the parents. Now to my testimony. Our organization is very concerned about parents being given the right to protect their families and their children from having information disclosed on them, not only about what's happening to them physically, but how they're thinking, what they're thinking, what their relationships are like, and their personal interactions. So it's one thing to offer help and assistance to a family. It's quite another to come into the home on the premise of offering help, but then collecting information on the family and the family not really knowing what's going on. We first saw this initiative, our organization, in 1997. And then in, I believe it was 2002, we asked for there to be real fully informed consent. And at that time, the proponent said that would have a chilling effect on their ability to do home visiting. And the fact that they use those words shows that a lot of people who knew or would know what was happening would actually perhaps make different decisions about whether they would let this person into their home. So I will let you know just a little bit about the data being collected. The Minnesota Department of Health document talks about what's called a home survey, which is home observation for measurement of the environment. The six items, following items are assessed: emotional and verbal responsivity, avoidance of restriction and punishment, safe and organized environment, provision of appropriate play material, involved or involvement with the child, opportunities for variety and daily stimulation. Data is collected, therefore, by the visitor according to the visitor's own values and value system and their own assessments, and sent to the Department of Health, where it creates a government record on the individual. And the individual is probably completely unaware of that. What is the impact on parents? In a 2000 study, it found that two mothers expressed fear that the visitors could take children away if they were perceived as not coping. We have two specific comments to make or suggestions. One, we would like full disclosure and parent consent and think it should be required prior to any disclosure. As you heard them talking about the different ways that they could find out who these families are, we would like it prior to that disclosure that they would consent for their information to be given, whether it's prenatally or postnatally. And full disclosure means that information that the parent is given includes the language of the statute on lines 119 to 130 of the bill. So I draw your attention to that, which shows that why they're being targeted and gives the individuals a better idea of what they are looking for. And then second, that they should be given the data tool that's being used to collect the data so that they understand exactly the data that's being collected on them and sent to the state government, and therefore they are fully informed about what's being collected and whether it will be used against them in the court of law or by social services, or whether they could be referred to social services as a result of that. So in conclusion, we do not support the data being sent to the government without consent of parents. Government entities or individuals coming into the hospital rooms without prior consent, or the homes without prior consent, or the assessment or collection of data on families without full disclosure of the purpose and the use of the data. And one thing, Mr. Chair, I'd like to ask, will this bill be going to judiciary since it opens up the number of families that this information could be collected on?
I think so.
Ms. Brace, I don't think the bill changes any of the data collection information. So we have not ever received a request from Judiciary Committee. But if they do request it, I mean, they can still request it from the floor as well.
Mr. Chair, we would appreciate the possibility of that. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Pritchard.
Yes, Mr. Chair. My name is Tom Pritchard, President of the Minnesota Family Council. And I'll just be brief. A number of comments were made that we had as well. I think we all recognize and desire to help children, but we would oppose this proposal because we believe it moves in the wrong direction. It basically expands a costly state bureaucracy to potentially all or most families. The new language talks about additional risk factors. It drops the income threshold at which they can go above. And also, the program must begin prenatally, so we see those as significant expansions. It promotes services to many parents who probably don't want or need them. And our concern is it could create, in a sense, a greater dependency on government rather than self-sufficiency. If you look at a list of the programs in the original bill, which I think would still be applicable to this amended version, significant number of programs. And if you look at the language on Subdivision 6, where it talks about outcomes that the commissioner is now expected to look at, it talks about program retention rates, number of home visits provided compared to the number of home visits planned, and you just see a lot of incentives there to expand the program and get more people into the program. So I see it as potentially being more intrusive and creating more dependency. And I think bottom line is you have to ask, is this the most effective way to help children? And as was already mentioned, many studies show that there aren't long-term gains to children in terms of their emotional health, behavioral problems, even child abuse. And so I think that's critical to realize and understand, especially if you have limited resources. What can be done? I think provide parents with the printed resources and let them decide whether they want further contact. We believe that we should move in the area of referrals to church, faith-based groups, churches, community groups, where you get people personally involved in helping parents and mothers raise their children rather than more of a state bureaucracy-driven system. And we believe that marriage is really the best program, early childhood program, in terms of helping children, preventing child abuse. Fathers in children's lives, reducing criminal activity and improving educational performance. So I think marriage is a way our state should be moving. And so finally, I just encourage the committee to look at other ways as opposed to just expanding a bureaucracy in ways to help children and parents. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Pritchard. Senator Bonoff.
Any questions of the members?
Senator Prettner-Solin.
Madam Chair, Senator Bonoff, actually my comments aren't to you, but I do take issue with much of the testimony, and I am not familiar with the New Freedom Commission report, but I do recognize that so many of these comments and references are to outdated studies and obscure studies that I'm not familiar with. And unfortunately, I don't have the references either to refute them, but there is far more research available today that shows brain studies that are being done and to show that interventions at this early age and mentoring that occurs at this early age can be very, very productive in the infants and the young child's life. So I wish I were able to go back and to check each of these references, but I do take issue with them.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Bonoff, Senator Fischbach jarred my memory. It was the same 17 long years ago that I gave birth to my son, and the intrusion in the hospital was endless. And once I got home, the phone calls were endless. And they wouldn't take no for an answer. They would very forcefully say, well, what would be a better time? But that isn't my concern with this bill. This bill is very concerning. It goes even further to the ECFE part. My child was in ECFE for 3 years before he went into kindergarten. I would have held him back, but because he passed all the roundup skills and was very developmentally able, they passed him on to kindergarten, and I think that was a mistake for him. ECFE made me feel as though I weren't responsible enough to make those decisions or smart enough as a parent. I regret that my son was in ECFE, and I would regret that this bill got passed.
Thank you, Senator Johnson.
Senator Dow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Bonoff. In Dakota County, we have a program similar to this, and I know that from it's been working very well. I've heard very good responses from it. And what I'd like to avoid is situations that we find in the newspaper where kids are being killed or seriously injured because we didn't catch them at a soon enough time. And if the worst case scenario is that we're getting too many phone calls and we have to push them off, so be it. I think we get a lot of phone calls on campaigns and the like that really irritate us all. And this particular situation, if we can save one child's life, I think it's worth it.
Mr. Chair, and it sounds like Ms. Ring might have some comments also. I think it's so important that people have an opportunity to testify here on bills and speak what their concerns are, because I think that is the way that we put together bills that truly are best for everyone. And so I do appreciate all the comments and take them into account. But what I also know is that this program is a lifeline for so many people. I have personally heard the stories of teenage parents who have said, you know, without this program, I might have hurt my child. And I'm here in support of this because I do think it is a way that we can extend our reach and target it to those who need it most. And so while I think there's always concerns, I think that we have to be respectful of families and of parents and make sure everything we're doing is standing beside them and empowering them, but not walk away from doing what's best for all kids.
Did you?
Senator Wergen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll keep it really short. I do become concerned when we start making our way into the home this young. I think there are value decisions that happen from the part of the person that does the home visit. In the first place, I'm not so sure that just a no does it. I have been told just a no does not do it, that the calls don't stop and the pressure doesn't stop for in-home services. And I do see, in my years of working with a lot of agencies and people and stuff, I have seen some pretty significant value judgments that I don't think should be there. And so I too have a big concern about this program and how intrusive it certainly could be and what value judgments it could make on families just because they operate a little differently than what we consider normal.
Thank you.
We are not always dealing with what somebody would call normal situations. I was thinking about the witnesses who said we ought to be promoting marriage, and I thought for the Judy, the 12-year-old mother, I'm not really sure that that's much of a solution to that, and I think this program has done wonderful things for her. But do I have a motion?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Prettner Solon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I recommend that Senate File Number 434 as amended be recommended to pass. I'm not sure where it needs to go.
Finance.
And that it be re-referred to the Finance Committee.
Senator Prettner Solon moves Senate File 434 as amended, referred to the Finance Committee. Discussion. If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you,
Thank
Senator Bonoff. We have several other bills and several other people from out of town, so I'd like to keep moving as fast as we can. Senator Roebling. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. I've been warned that we need to be brief to get as much in as possible, so I would like to immediately offer the A1 amendment.
Senator.
Oh, and Mr. Chair, I do have to make one little correction. On page 6 of the A1 amendment, on line 3, it says, or private agency. This needs to be deleted as part of the amendment.
Incorporated in that on line, page 6, line 3, delete or private agency. Senator Worgen moves the A1 amendment with that change incorporated in it. Is there any discussion on the amendment? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Okay, members, before 2003, our family daycare providers were not charged a fee for licensing or background checks. And During that time when we were cutting aid to counties, the counties came in and asked if they could recoup some of their costs for running those services or providing those services. And at the time, we allowed them to charge up to $100 a year or no more than their costs, no more than their costs or up to $100 a year for background checks, and then up to $150 per year for the actual license. And some counties decided to charge fees. Some counties didn't charge fees. In your packet of handouts, which I don't know, I think they've been distributed or are being distributed, there's a sheet that shows what each county is currently charging for licensing fees and background checks, and they're pretty much all over the board. I think only one county charges the maximum of $150 per year for the licensing fee. Many of them charge $100 for the background checks, but some of them don't charge anything. It is quite a wide range. And so in talking to the people from the Minnesota Licensed Family Child Care Association and my good friend and former daycare provider, Dolores Frisky, who works with that association and is a licensed provider, we came up with this proposal that we would like to have a more standard. It doesn't have to be standard, though, but we want to bring these down, these fees down. And we believe, too, that it will encourage people to become licensed providers if the fees are not so high. So this bill proposes to drop that annual top fee for licensing down to $50. And then it also proposes that the Department of Human Services take over the background checks for the providers. And there is a blank appropriation in here at this time that would provide money for DHS in order to take over the background checks. Currently, the child care centers do not pay for their background checks. They are done by the state, and there is no fee charge to them. So it's kind of an equity issue for licensed child care providers so that each would be treated the same. And I have with me some of our providers who would like to comment on this and why this has become a big, important issue to them. And first of all, I'd like Dolores Frisky to speak.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. I am Dolores Frisky, licensed family child care provider from Scott County, representing the Scott County Family Child Care Association. I'd like to bring 2 points to your attention here, and that's a combination of our net income to justify the bringing the cap licensing fee to $50 for a one-year license and $100 for a two-year license from the current fee. One of the things providers have asked me throughout since 2003 is, do counties understand how little we make as family child care providers? Well, I did some research on this based on the 2006 numbers of the Child Care Resource and Referral System, whom you guys fund also. And we have found that 30 to 33% of a provider's gross income is their net income. Added to this, we also found the realistic facts that most family child care providers are not full to capacity as our licensing rule allows us to be because of two factors. One is best practice that we choose not to be. Second is because of the current economy in a lot of our counties. We found through the Child Care Resource and Referral Numbers Study, counties went as low as 5.5 children in care to a top of 10. From the Child Care Resource and Referral numbers. We also looked at the cost, the average cost of child care in the respective counties. It is fascinating to see that when you take the 7-county metro area and you go out state, the numbers decrease substantially. The highest in 2006, based on an average number in Scott County, which happened to be the highest number, was $14,685 as our net income. It dropped down to, and this just about made me cry, $5,676 in Nobles County. That kind of money, we have to realize, is very slim to pay bills on and also to be productive taxpayers in our state. The second thing is you must also realize is that a lot of family child care providers have their own children in care. These children are not paying children. And they are all included in this total numbers that our child care resource and referral system gives us. On top of that, I'd like to just say that we did a poll in 2003 prior to you passing the previous bill. Family child care providers gave us two things to work for. Number one is they felt that they could afford a $50 license fee. So that's what we're back here requesting at this time, a $50 per year license fee. $100 for 2 years. And the other interesting thing is that out of the counties in the state, and so you don't have to sit and figure all this stuff out, 30 counties have chosen to do the full 250 at some point in our license process. Out of these counties, 44 counties in our state have been realistic with us and given us reasonable fees. So we are very pleased with that. We are also pleased the way you wrote the bill last time, allowing counties not to charge fees if they so chose, and we appreciate you keeping that. What we are requesting here is that this fee providers feel is a reasonable to pay, and we're asking you to support us on that. The last thing I'd like to bring to your attention is a background study. It's called the Human Services Background Studies. It's a state statute. 245C, period 10, states background study fees. The subject of background studies, no applicant, license holder, or individual who is the subject of the background study shall pay any fees required to conduct the study. We feel that with the transfer that is Senator Roebling and Mr. Jerry Kerber has worked out in this bill, we are excited to be part of the background studies done by the state of Minnesota. This makes a very level playing field, as Senator Roebling said, for both family child care and center care. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Friske.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Berglund.
If I could just ask one question, Senator Roebling. I believe that the centers pay a licensing fee to the state.
Yes.
And so then that's part of the way that we cover the cost of their background checks is by charging them that fee, and we do not charge a fee to family licensed daycare. The state does not.
Mr. Chair and Senator Berglund, the state does not charge a fee to the family child care. That is correct. The license, the centers do pay a licensing fee, but the family child cares are also paying a licensing fee and a background check fee. So they're paying two separate fees right now.
Well, Mr. Chairman, my only point is that if the state is going to take over the cost of doing background checks for the family daycare, we don't collect any licensing fee from them at this time to help cover the cost of that.
That is correct.
You want to continue with witnesses, and again, I will request that people be brief because we have a lot of bills yet.
What time are we supposed to say? Hi. 2:30.
My name is Deborah Dill, and I have been a licensed child care provider in Dakota County for over 12 years. Being a child care provider is a profession that is very rewarding. This summer, an 11-year-old, Morgan, wrote me a beautiful thank you letter when it was time for her to no longer be in my child care. Morgan had grown up in my care. She said that I was much more than a daycare lady. I'd helped her to learn, told her good stories, and comforted her when she was sad. She said she hoped that I would never forget her, and I will never forget her or her big sister, little brother, or any other of the children that grew up in my child care. For many providers such as me, income can be very inconsistent as we gain and lose families. It seems about 2 years ago, I started to lose long-term families due to the fact that the children had grown to the point of not needing my services any longer. Replacement of these families was not an easy task. It seemed that the only children available were infants and toddlers, but I was already at my capacity for these age groups. I was making less and less money each month. Soon I found that I was no longer meeting my financial needs. With all this, paying a biannual license and background check fee of $250 in Dakota County is quite a burden. I had to borrow money to pay my fee. This is not a good way for a business to be run. In the end, I had to make the difficult decision to leave my profession. I am not the only one who has left for these reasons in the Apple Valley area. I have talked to four other providers who have already left their profession for similar reasons. With Senate File 536, family child care providers will have a lower statewide licensing fee to help keep quality and affordable child care in our communities. So our children have a safe and caring environment to learn and to develop into caring, productive young adults. Thank you for this opportunity to speak to you today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak. My name is Beth Mork. I'm the past director for the Minnesota Licensed Family Child Care Association. We were food program sponsors for the state of Minnesota. My testimony has to do with the fact that when we've talked to providers who were dropping the food program, some of those providers shared with us that the reason that they had to drop the food program was because they were dropping their license because of the licensing fees that had been implemented. Providers are not asking that there not be a licensing fee, but that there be a more equitable licensing fee. Right now in Olmsted County, a licensed family child care provider pays five times what a doctor from the Mayo Clinic pays for his license. They pay 13 times more than a teacher pays for her teaching license. So it's the equity issue. Also, by having the background checks become part of the statewide system, the way the state is gearing up to do background checks, anyone who has a background check performed would be flagged then to have any information that came up afterwards go back into the system. So you'd be protected from people having a disqualifier show up and not catching that disqualifier. And that's another thing that we're asking for the protection of children. It makes sense to have background checks done by the state rather than by the county. If a provider moves county to county, we're afraid that flagging won't happen that way. And our state is putting a system in place to make that happen. We've also had providers who have said that they're dropping either their liability insurance or they're dropping other educational programs from their child care homes to make up the money that happened with the licensing fee. When the licensing fee was implemented, it was implemented rather quickly and in such a way that many providers never found out about it until they actually applied for their license. And when the licensing application came out or the licensor showed up, they were all of a sudden told that they had a $250 licensing fee. Some of these counties did it in such a way that they requested the provider have it either in the form of a cashier's check or cash when the license was paid. For people who are providing child care in their home 10 to 12 hours a day, it's difficult to get to the bank to arrange for cashier's checks and for cash. And I know of no other license where people were treated that way, where they had to pay for it with a cashier's check rather than have their license done. So it's just the whole equity thing. You know, making the fare reasonable based on the income that these family child care providers making it part of a statewide system for the background check so that things are done in an equitable way and we catch the things that we need to catch to protect our children. Those are the things that are important to us to have happen with this. I did give my testimony in writing and stuff too, so people have that.
Thank you very much, Ms. Moore.
Hello, my name is Polly Salazar, and I'm the project director for underrepresented communities doing leadership capacity. And the reason I'm here today to testify is because I wanted to give a more practical idea of what's happening with the families that I'm working with. Many of the women who we want to become more professional in what they do and give them quality care to the children that they're working with, we ask them to become licensed providers. And when they initially start to do this application for licensing, they're charged the $250, many of whom may or may not have a job at that time because they've decided to change their profession. And in requesting this license fee, the $250 initially, they have to either, as they've said before, borrow the money or get the money from some other source. And this makes it very difficult for them because those who may want to become potential license providers are prohibited from doing this because they don't have the opportunity to pay that licensing fee. And I just think that if we were able to pass and support Senate File 536, that we would be able to bring not just from the primary communities, but from all of the communities that I'm working with, more of an opportunity to become child care providers, making it more inclusive for all of the communities that I'm working with.
Thank you, Ms. Salazar. Questions from the committee? Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Roebling, do you know how much a background check costs at this point?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Dahl, it's my understanding that the state can actually get a background check run through the system for a couple of dollars, maybe like two?
It's eight.
Or eight? It's $8?
It's eight.
$8. And because they have negotiated an arrangement with the BCA to do that, and the counties apparently don't get quite the same price, is my understanding, probably based on the volume even. And so it probably does cost more for the counties to do it at this point. And the state now is initiating a system where you only have to enter them once, and if any new incident comes up, that information is kicked back. So you don't have to run the background check every year, which I think many of the counties are doing currently, where the state would not have to do that. So it would, at this point, it would be more efficient for the state to take over that that process.
But for the background checks for the individuals, it's $125.
Okay, Mr. Chair. So would we be subsidizing then if it's $125 by capping it at $50? I guess I missed what you're saying there.
I'm not sure.
The cost to the individual caregiver in some cases, like if you have a single provider where she only needs one background check on her family, there isn't a differentiation at the county level. They're charging them still the $100.
Thank you.
Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Roebling. I represent Olmsted County, so I feel compelled to weigh in here. And I guess the question that I have in my mind, and I've heard from a number of child care providers in my district, and I hear what they're saying. I also hear from my county, and I'm wondering if this is is this an unfunded mandate? My question is, I think that regardless of whether or not you're the provider or you're the county, that we want background checks done for these providers. I think that's something that we all share, but I'm not necessarily convinced that the county should be subsidizing that. So my question really follows along the lines of Senator Dahl. Can we work together so that one is not subsidizing the other?
Mr. Chair and Senator Lynch, what we're proposing with the background checks is that the counties would eliminate that from one of their responsibilities. They would be responsible for collecting the basic information on the license application, the full name of the applicant and the people who will be working in that family home, their date of births and their addresses. And then this is already collected when they're applying for licenses. That would be forwarded to the state so that they would do the background checks using that information. And that would be the county's involvement with the background checks. So they wouldn't be collecting the fee for it, but they wouldn't be running the background checks either. And then when information, that information would kick back to the county so they could complete the licensing. But the actual license fee is the thing that may be of concern to you. The background check would not be a burden to the counties anymore under this proposal. But right now, some of them, like Olmsted County, are charging $150 a year, and this is saying we want them to only charge $50 a year. Most counties are currently charging an initial fee. My county, for example, of Scott, charges $150 the first year, and then they go into a two-year cycle of $150 for a two-year license. This would be $100 for a two-year license. The county would be losing $50 on that proposal. Your county would be losing slightly more. A lot of counties won't lose anything because they don't charge anywhere near that much. So it depends where your county is right now, what they would lose. A lot of them might lose $50 in a two-year cycle, and that is something that you know, some people will have to consider. But it would, you know, we're looking for some equity among providers across the state and a way to encourage more people to become licensed.
Senator Lynch.
Senator Marty, Senator Rowling, thanks for the that follow-up. I don't think that Olmsted County or any county, I like to believe, is looking at this as a way to supplement their funds at all. And if we can get to the point where it's a more efficient process and some of these things are streamlined and fees are assessed accordingly, I think that sounds like a good business decision.
Sir Higgins.
Mr. Chair, I have a couple of questions for Senator Roebling. Do you know how many child care providers we have who are not licensed? And at some point, are we going to get to the point where we license everybody? You know, you and I have been in committees for years on, and we've had that discussion, and I'm just wondering what an update is, if anybody happens to know. Maybe Mr. Kerber knows.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Jerry Kerber, and I'm the Director of the Licensing Division at the Department of Human Services. And Senator Higgins, to your question, I don't know how many unlicensed providers there are right now. Off the top of my head, there are some numbers that we can get you about the number of unlicensed child care providers who are participating in the child care assistance program. But when you talk about unlicensed child care providers, you're talking about you and I watching our neighbor's kids for some period of time. I mean, it's the full range of informal care is sort of included in that description. But there are numbers available that I don't have today that pertain to those who are receiving child care assistance that I can get for you.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Kerber, part of, I guess, where I was going to was one of the witnesses, and I don't remember who, said that, you know, some of the providers were saying when they got their licensing bill, you know, that they were just going to go to be unlicensed instead. And, you know, that's not serving us well in any way, shape, or form, I don't think. So have you been seeing people dropping their licenses and continuing to work?
Mr. Chair and Senator Higgins, I think whether or not you're licensed is not necessarily your own decision. If you can't simply choose to provide the same level of care without a license legally. It's a misdemeanor to operate a child care service that's required to be licensed without a license. And so there would have to be some changes to the services that they choose to provide so that they are no longer required to be licensed.
Mr. Kerber, could you give us an example of that?
So, for example, Senator Higgins, there are roughly about, there's close to 13,000 family child care providers now. If I'm a licensed family child care provider, I'm licensed because I am choosing to serve children from more than one unrelated family. So I can serve my own kids, my brother's kids, and I can serve my neighbor's kids, and if I'm going to serve any other unrelated kids in addition to my neighbor's kids, then I have to have a license. If I choose to be unlicensed because I don't want to pay the licensure fee, If any of those kids are getting child care assistance, I'm still going to have a background study, but I won't have to pay the licensure fee, but I will not be able to continue providing care for two unrelated families' kids at the same time. I'd have to notch
one,
it back.
One, but not two.
Just one unrelated family without a license.
Okay. Ms. Mork, did you want to comment on that?
Yeah, according to the Minnesota Resource and Referral Agencies, they share with us that over 50% of all of the care done in homes is done in unlicensed homes, family, friends, and neighbor care, or legally unlicensed homes. And we have lost over 1,000 licensed family child care providers since the fees were implemented in 2003.
Senator Wergen.
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, I kind of hope we never reach the point where we all have to be licensed to take care of kids, because I think there's some wonderful care that happens in some unlicensed settings. But that being said, I think there is an advantage to the license. And if, in fact, you want to reach more people to be licensed, then this bill goes in the right direction because it lowers the cost of a license so that more people can access it.
Mr. Chair, Senator, we're going to, I guess it just sticks in my craw that we have something in statute called legal unlicensed. I mean, it's just weird. I'm sorry.
Better than illegally licensed, perhaps.
I suppose there's that, yeah. The illegal unlicensed.
Senator Higgins, wish to make a motion?
Sure. I'll move the bill for Senator Roebling.
Senator Higgins moves Senate File 536 as amended be recommended, passed, and referred to the Committee on Finance. Is there a discussion of that motion? Not all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, members.
Senator Thomasoni, I understand most of your witnesses are from out of town. So.
Yeah, he's been here.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. Mr. Chairman, I have an A1 amendment that I think I want to put on the bill, if I can do that first.
I'll get move it.
Senator Berglund moves the A1 amendment. Is there any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. Senate File 639 is an assistive technology study with some appropriations. And what it does is it requires the Council on Disability to study assistive technology issues and to provide oversight and direction to Minnesota Region's Assistive Technology Collaborative. Section 1 requires the Council on Disability to facilitate a study and to report by January 1st of 2009 with a comprehensive plan to meet the assistive technology needs of persons with disabilities, conditions, and seniors. The Council must also provide oversight and direction to the Minnesota Region's Assistive Technology Collaborative during the upcoming biennium, and then Section 2 appropriates $200,000 to the Department of Human Services for the study, $300,000 each year to DHS to support the collaborative, and $200,000 to the Department of Administration as the state's final share of the local match for a federal grant that provides microloans to individuals to acquire assistive technology services and devices. Mr. Chairman, this bill is basically targeted at finding people who need these assistive technology devices and who aren't getting them, or who are underserved as a result of either not knowing or not being able to acquire the technology that their particular disability requires. And to elaborate on this bill, Mr. Chairman, I have Carol J. Fury, who can start out with her testimony, and then we'll move to the other witnesses.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Carol Fury, and I'm the Director of Assistive Technology in Minnesota, and I realize that time is of the essence, so I'm going to skip most of my discussion unless you have questions for me, and just go over briefly the components of the bill. There are over 770,000 people in Minnesota who have identified themselves as having a disability. There are many other people in Minnesota who have acquired a disability and don't consider themselves to be disabled, particularly our seniors. Many of the people that we're serving who are over the age of 65 or 70 have hearing, vision, and mobility losses, but they do not consider themselves to be disabled. In order to get around to meet their own needs, to be independent in their homes for seniors, many of them are already using adaptive equipment. And that's really what this bill is all about. It's about assistive technology or adaptive equipment. Currently in Minnesota, we do not have an AT policy. One of the things that really seems to be missing is a statewide plan to help the people who are providers in Minnesota and the state agencies work together in a cohesive manner and a coordinated manner to, number one, identify who are the people with disabilities who need equipment, what are the barriers that impact their inability to get the equipment they need, and then how can we go about making sure that they have the equipment that they need. The study will help us to do that, to put together a roadmap that will help all of the agencies, such as the Department of Education, Health, Human Services, DEED, Administration, and the 12 to 15 nonprofits in Minnesota that are the ones who are doing all the work in assistive technology. As a result of that study, we would ask that the council, the State Council on Disability, bring back to the legislature in 2 years the results of the study and a plan that can be adopted by the state to ensure access to adaptive equipment. The additional two components of the bill, one will help fully fund a low-interest loan program that is already in existence. It is a federal grant that was awarded to the state back in 2004, which required a federal match, or excuse me, a local match. And that local match is a 3-to-1, meaning that the federal government will provide $3 for every dollar we match. As of this point, we have raised 230 of the required $430,000 for that match, and we've implemented the program. In 2 years, we have provided $870,000 in low-interest loans to help people buy equipment. Of that, almost $200,000 was to guarantee loans for people who either were low income or had creditworthiness issues and were unable to receive a traditional loan. So obviously we're seeing that there's a huge need in the area of funding. And the third part of the bill actually provides funds for the Minnesota Region's Assistive Technology Collaborative, which is a consortium of providers primarily in greater Minnesota that are doing the work supporting individuals with disabilities and seniors in greater Minnesota. And with that, I will really kind of stop my testimony and defer to Judy Manning, who is from Greater Minnesota, to help you understand the needs of the regional assistive technology program.
Thank you, Ms. Frey. Ms. Manning.
Thank you. My name is Judy Manning. I'm executive director of United Cerebral Palsy of Central Minnesota. We're located in St. Cloud, and we serve individuals with disabilities in Stearns, Benton, and Sherburne counties. I come here with 29 years of experience as executive director of UCP, so I've had a lot of background in working with people with disabilities, and our organization and agency recognized the need for assistive technology over 10 years ago and made it a primary focus of our organization. I'm passing the photos around today as an example of some of our clients who use assistive technology, and it doesn't always mean it's something necessary like a wheelchair, but it can be something fun like a bowling ramp. It can be something fun like a three-wheel bicycle. And the other photo also shows a young girl using a communication device, which is crucial to about 90% of people with cerebral palsy who have their speech affected in some way. So we work a lot with different types of communication devices. I'm also here as a representative of the Mid-Minnesota Assistive Technology Network. Since its inception, I've been a member for 8 years. We serve 14 counties in central and northern Minnesota, Crow Wing, Cass, Todd, Mille Lacs, Morrison, Wadena, Benton, Stearns, Sherburn, Wright, Kennebec, Pine, Chisago, and Isani counties. With the financial and consulting advice of the Assistive Technology Network, UCP started their Computers Go Round program about 6 years ago, and since then we have recycled over 400 quality used computers to individuals with disabilities. And this is assistive technology. This is not something that's covered by your insurance company. It's an item people have to look for funding to find this assistive technology and help them to lead a more independent life. So what we're talking about in assistive technology is independence. It's making your life easier. A couple years ago, my mother-in-law told me what a difficult time she was having putting her socks on in the morning. And I said, well, you know, there's a device you can use that you don't have to reach down. You can pull that sock on. Well, you know, then she was able to get dressed by herself. She didn't have to have somebody to come in and do that for her. So it's all about living a more independent life. It can be a real simple device. It can be a reacher or a grabber. It can be a very complicated device like an $8,000 communication device. So it covers a wide array of equipment to help people live more independently. It helps them get out in the community. One of the big items that we're always looking for are handicapped accessible vans. People are looking for funding for this type of equipment. And also, it's important to create an awareness about the assistive technology that is available and is out there for people who just aren't aware of it, such as my mother-in-law, who didn't know that there were some of these simple devices that could make her life so much easier. So the Assistive Technology Network makes an effort to get out in the community and notify people about the devices that are available and how it can create a greater sense of independence for them. It's transportation. It's having a social life. It's being able to communicate with a computer, with your friends and relatives. And it's about making your quality of life much better. Thank you.
Thank you. Hi. My name is Patty Barr. I'm a rehabilitation engineer with Gillette Children's Specialty Healthcare. I also am supervisor of our mobile outreach clinic. I work with many people at Gillette that provide assistive technology. I work on the technology, and I work closely with speech-language pathologists, occupational therapists, physical therapists. And then when I'm on the road in greater Minnesota in one of 20 sites where we serve people with disabilities, I work with therapists and community providers to look at assistive technology, to really match different types of assistive technology to the needs of people with disabilities. As I said, all the work I do is with assistive technology, and as Judy said, assistive technology has a broad definition. It can be as simple as a pencil grip to make it easier to write. It can be voice input to a computer. Some of the people I work with power mobility, special seating systems, in wheelchairs, making braces for people so that they can stand and walk and sit comfortably. The point about assistive technology that I want to make is that it's really necessary for people of all ages with various disabling conditions to learn, to work, and to live more productive lives. It's cost effective for people with disabilities to be more independent and productive. As they're able to learn and work, they'll be able to pay taxes. It's cost effective for care providers. Less care is needed when assistive technology is available to people. For example, a powered wheelchair can allow a person to independently push themselves rather than having someone else push them. Also, overhead lifts that are available can allow patient transfers or client transfers with one person rather than two people, making care more cost-effective. Some of the assistive technology that I work with is paid for through medical insurance or school systems. Other types of equipment is not, and that is why I think it's important that you help with the federal match for the low-interest loan program, and that is one of our components. The needs analysis is also important, and that's another portion of this file. I work with people from all over the state in 20 different cities in greater Minnesota, as well as people here in the Twin Cities metro area. Professionals as well as people with disabilities have found that the system is fragmented. We don't always know who to go to for funding or to help people. Documentation is different depending on the funding source. Setup and training is limited. I mean, why get a piece of equipment if you can't learn to use it and be able to use it independently? It needs to be set up. We need to know how to fund that, how to figure it out. And ongoing support is limited. And for people like me, I can't even get my time paid for, and so it's all grant-funded. Coordination between service providers, although we love to work together, sometimes we just are not able to work together as well as we might. If we had a chance to sit down and figure out what's working, what's not working, and I think that if we can have this needs analysis funded, come up with a plan, I think it'd be great. As far as the assistive technology networks, I was involved with...
Ms. Barr, please do hurry because we're very short on time. So
I was involved with the assistive technology networks in developing them, and they're very important to provide input to people, to provide, like for me, so that I know what to bring with me to Greater Minnesota to help folks. Thank you.
Thank you. One quick question for Ms. Fury or whomever. The terminology on 1.9, people with disabling conditions, is that meant to distinguish from people with disabilities? I know we have some legal definitions of that, but this is a study. Is there a reason that language was picked, do you know?
Mr. Chair, the use of disabling conditions is broader, than the label disabled persons. So it allows an individual who has a short-term disability to be included versus an individual who is considered disabled would be permanently disabled.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the bill.
Then do you want to allow, on page 1, line 12, then do you want to allow it be limited to disabled persons, allow disabled persons instead of... I mean, I always thought the persons with disability referred to long and short term.
Mr. Chair, I'll defer that back to the committee for, change is fine.
This will be going to finance. So if somebody can take a look and see if that's what you wanted. Senator Higgins moved Senate File 639 as amended be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chairman, real quickly, there were a whole bunch of people I bowled with the other day when at the governor's bowling that could have used.
Done better with that? I can't believe it. On Senator Higgins' motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. If members of the committee can put the remaining stuff from the other two bills we didn't get to back in their folders, we'll save staff time. And I want to alert people to the fact that we are not getting through the bills quite as fast as we'd like, and we will be having some extra meetings, I presume, next week.
Yes.
Friday. This Friday?
Friday morning or afternoon?
This Friday afternoon. With that, the meeting is adjourned.
This Friday at 12:30?
Yes.